You have to really ask yourself about Esther. I know, by the way, you know, this was introduced last week. I'm going to try to just summarize the whole book. It's 10 chapters, but it's not a hard book interpretively, but you really have to come to it and say, why is this book here? Martin Luther felt that there were two books that shouldn't be in the Bible. One was James, the other was Esther. And I don't consider him an authority in any sense, like he's the one that would determine it. But it's just to say people have struggled for a long time. Can you think of why there would be a question as to whether Esther should be in the Bible or not? God's name's not mentioned. Hey, what else? You see that odd, right, that a Bible book wouldn't actually say God in it? That's like someone calling a song a Christian song and they don't say nothing about God or Jesus. Someone else? It has a focus on a lady, although in a Jewish mindset, the hero of the book is who? Who would you think the hero would be? Mordecai. But when you read it, obviously Esther's pivotal. Is Esther a woman of strong morals? Yeah. You know, a lot of times when the book gets taught, it gets taught through rose-colored glasses, and we'll talk a little about that. But Esther has problems. Her name, Esther, means star, like Ishtar, which is why a lot of folks have a problem with the holiday being called Easter, because that is the god of sex and war. I mean, it's just a fact. Mordecai, his name's Mordecai. He's mentioned outside the Bible, by the way. It's not like this stuff's just made up. We have extensive history of this time period through Herodotus and other historians. And Mordecai is the god of that they serve. The storm god is Marduk. And so you get Mordecai. You can hear it. It means worshiper of Marduk. So the hero of our story is named worshiper of Marduk. And unlike Daniel, who gets renamed and he's given a pagan name, we know Daniel has a Hebrew name that means God judges. Where's Mordecai's Hebrew name? What happened? Remember, we were studying Daniel and Ezekiel and even Jeremiah a long time ago, and they go into captivity under Nebuchadnezzar for 70 years. What's supposed to happen after the 70 years? Supposed to return home. They didn't go home. Why didn't Mordecai and Esther go home when God, through the prophet, said, return home? They liked it there. That's right. They liked it more where they were at. They had obtained positions of comfort and wealth. So you can see why some people would say, well, maybe this book really isn't in the Bible. And then there's no prayer. Although, by the way, we talked in Hebrews a lot about the fact that the book of Hebrews quotes the Old Testament, but it quotes the Greek version of the Old Testament called the Septuagint. The Greek version of Esther is totally different. The Greek version of Esther is full of prayers and references to God because they perceived the problem. And so they just filled in stuff and made Mordecai and Esther praying folks. But it didn't hear in the text. In the Qumran scrolls that were discovered around 1947 or 48, a little boy in Israel throws a pebble into a cave and hears pottery breaking. And he comes to discover one of the biggest gold mines of ancient text ever found. Every book in the Old Testament, either we have the whole script or part of it, discovered from this Qumran community, people that lived right around the Dead Sea at the same time Jesus lived, and their texts, their copies of the Old Testament books, date to 200 or 100 B.C. Our King James Bible that I'm using is using Hebrew text that date to 1200 A.D. So we have texts all of a sudden that are so much older, and they had every one of them, a complete version of Daniel. Up until the late 40s, scholars said Daniel was written contemporaneous with Jesus or shortly before. But then they had a copy of Daniel that's like 150, 200 B.C., which means all the stuff in Daniel really is prophecy. But guess what was missing? Esther. the one book in the Old Testament that wasn't there. I could see someone saying, well, maybe Song of Solomon's not in. It's a very erotic book, but Esther, not there. So just understand that you have that as a background. It's an interesting history. So we have to say, well, then why is it in the Bible? What is it? And I hope as we go through it, you kind of see what comes out of this. God's name doesn't have to be mentioned for God to be active. Often that happens in our lives. God is active and we don't recognize it, and that's our sin. But we can get into a problem when we think, I didn't see God, so he wasn't there. And this is one of those books, as you're reading along as the reader, the characters don't necessarily seem to see God, but we do, if we'll look for him. So in the first chapter, we get reference to Ahasuerus. This is the king. What's another name for him? Spelling. What's his name?
Xerxes.
Xerxes is a good Greek name. And then he has a Persian name that I can't spell because it has like five consonants in a row. But he's a king. Now, who was his dad? Remember?
Darius.
Yeah. Darius or Darius. Darius the first. He's the one that allows the rebuilding of the temple back around 520 BC. That's the subject of the book of Haggai and the book of Zechariah that we'll do coming up. And so when he dies, this guy becomes king, and he rules from, got it down here, from 486 to 465. And you know some of the story. He's got a problem, right? And what's her name?
Vashti.
Now, this is his queen. And in the literature, it is outside the Bible. This is her name. And we have lots recorded outside the Bible about her. What does she do wrong? What does Vashti do wrong that angers the king?
She's a disobedient woman.
A disobedient woman, that's right.
So
the king says, what's the background that leads up to him saying to Amestris or Vashti, I want you to come before my presence? Remember what's going on? Little party, right? How long does the party last?
6 months.
Yeah. So you have a 6-month party. This party is recorded in history also. And the speech that it culminated in was a long speech. And I thought about putting it on a PowerPoint, but it's like 4 pages in a book. He's having all the rich folk from all around this kingdom, which we're told in like the second verse, stretches all the way to India from Ethiopia. When you're reading the Old Testament, it says Ethiopia. Don't think modern Ethiopia. It's Kush. Kush is a substantial part of Africa, and it plays a substantial role in Scripture, by the way. The Old Testament, it gets missed a lot of times, but it's from Kush to India. Okay? Moses married a lady from Kush. That means that Moses, who was not black, married a lady that was black. And, you know, and that caused all kinds of problems with Moses' sister, but God gave Moses' sister leprosy and said, I don't have a problem with the marriage. That's a freebie on the side. But you understand that just as a substantial part of, I mean, this was a huge area, Kush, all the way to the Indus River. And he starts bringing in these rich folks for this party to try to talk them into going to war in Greece. And if you've seen the movie 300, you think the Greeks were tough guys or church boys that would never pick up a weapon and fight. Yeah. I mean, this idea he has of going and taking Greece, his dad tried to do it and got humiliated, and he says, now we're going to go take Greece. Well, he spends 6 months doing this, and the way they negotiate and form alliances and make decisions is you get stone cold drunk. Decide what you're going to do, because in that drunkenness, the gods give you wisdom. And then the next day, more sober minds come back to try to confirm it. Maybe they confirm it, maybe they don't. But that's what this 6-month party is. And at the end of it, he gives a speech and says, you know,
Darius tried to take it and it didn't work out, and we need to go revenge him and go and take Athens. Specifically, take Athens. Doesn't work out. Now, at the end of the six-month party, he calls for the queen, and she won't come. And the script simply doesn't say why. Uh-huh. There's no doubt that she is the original trophy wife. What's disputed is whether he was asking her to come parade around butt naked or not, because of something the text says. It says put a crown on her. That's possible. There's a recording in the ancient literature of another king doing something like that, but it was done in a more private setting. I don't think that's what it is, but it just doesn't tell you. But the fact is, she's summoned. Understand that to be in the king's presence is a high honor. For a very simple reason. If you're in the king's presence, you can ask for a favor. If you're never in the king's presence, you can never ask for a favor. I mean, it's very simple. And so to be called to his presence, and by the way, you don't get to just go into his presence because you're married to him. That's very clear in the book. You must be summoned or put in a formal request and wait for him to call you. If he never calls you, he never calls you. So she comes in, at the end of the 6 months, she's having her own little party. Who's her party for?
The women.
The women. Which women?
The noble women.
Yeah.
She's teaching them how to be disobedient.
Do you think
disobedient party?
Well, that's how it's pitched. But do you think Ahasuerus was not awesome?
My wife ain't here. She's out there.
Yeah, but there's a lot of people can go talk to her. This guy, Ahasuerus, is not monogamous. And she is, Vashti is having this thing, I think, for the harem. But the harem becomes prominent later because of what happens. But just understand, she won't come. We're not really told why. We can debate it. I will tell you one thing. The timing is such, because we know that after this scene, she never gets to see the king again. It's very difficult without seeing him to get pregnant. The successor to Ahasuerus is a king named Artaxerxes I, who is her son, which means, because he had only been in power like 3 years at this point, that she is either pregnant or has recently given birth to Artaxerxes. It could be as simple as she doesn't really want to go out with a baby bump parading in front of people. I mean, who knows? But she's had her son. She is a very powerful person. And we have a lot of history about the fact of like how she liked to kill people. This guy liked to have lots of girlfriends. And he had a girlfriend in another city that he would see when the very vindictive Vashti was not there. Vashti made him what we might think of as the proverbial coat of many colors. And after he went on this date and really found favor with this young lady, he said to her, "I'll give you whatever you want." She said, "I want that coat that you're wearing," because she knew Vashti made it, so she could parade around in the coat that the queen made for the king. And he tried to talk her in. He said, "I'll give you a city. I'll give you an army at your command." And she said no, and she insisted on the coat. She rode that coat around, and Vashti found out. Vashti couldn't kill this girlfriend because he liked her, so Vashti killed her mother. Chopped off breast, her ears, and her nose publicly. Vashti wielded a great deal of power, and she is not a nice woman. Do not feel sorry for this guy or this lady when you read this story. They are very vile people. Life has no value in their kingdom. And so you see what happens. You do not disobey the king, and so she does. And as we know, she is not killed, but she's essentially exiled from his presence forever. So what happens after that?
Well, you see at the beginning of chapter 2, he comes back from battle. Now, we're not told that, but it says after these days, he started thinking about this lady. Why doesn't he just go to her?
Right.
Pride, perhaps. But is there anything about the law? How do laws work in Persia? I don't know if you heard talk about that last week. You know, we make laws and unmake them, right? That's just how it is. And you can repeal a law. In this culture, laws cannot be repealed even by the king.
he made a law that she could never be in his presence. What really happens between chapter 1 and 2 that's not recorded is he then goes and tries to take the Greeks. It's always a bad idea to try to take the Greeks. Alexander conquers the world with 30,000 Greeks. If you want to summon some soldiers to fight, that's where you go. And he fails, and when he gets home with his tail between his legs, he starts thinking it's a little cold at night. And so he wants to go to her. Now imagine what happens if she gets popular again. That is, if she comes back in the king's graces. When you read chapter 1, there were advisors around the king that said, kick her out. What's going to happen to those men if she gets to be queen again? Yeah, off with their heads, right? The Red Queen on Alice, off with their heads. That's what's going to happen. So they say, you know what, you don't want her back, king. Let's do a beauty contest. We'll find Miss Persia. Where's Persia anyway? Where's Persia?
Iran,
right? This whole story takes place in Iran, in Susa, or Shushan in our Bible, but Susa, which is Iran. So he says, that, you know, the advisors don't want this lady to come back and kill him. So they say, let's have a beauty contest. We'll go gather women from all over your kingdom and bring them here. How does he select Esther? Is it like on Miss America and you get to ask some questions and she says, well, I want just some world peace. Is that how these ladies get their job? Is that what they're judged on? Their talent, they can get up there and sing? How does he select them? Well, let's just be real. What's it say?
The interview, right?
There's not a lot of questions asked in the interview. Okay? These ladies, they gather them from all over the kingdom. They spend a whole year in preparation. And then he tries them one night at a time until he gets to Esther. If they fail the test, that is to say, you know, he spends the night with them, but he doesn't want them to take Vashti's position, they go to the harem. The harem means that you'll be in the lap of luxury the rest of your life inside a cage. You will never have contact with your family again. That's why Esther never talks to Mordecai. She passes messages to him in the book through servants. So to be in the harem is to live the life of widowhood, as it were, unless at some point the king starts thinking and says, I'll summon so-and-so by name. He could always do that. But you may never see him again. And so you'll spend your whole life in that sort of cage. Who takes care of the women there?
The eunuchs.
The eunuchs, right? All right, they have a certain incapacity. You can understand why the king's going to put his women over there and put men in charge of them that have that incapacity. You know, we miss that sometimes. My King James says chamberlains or something, but they're eunuchs, like Daniel was a eunuch. Right? We don't think about that when we read it, but Daniel was put under the master of the eunuchs. There's a reason he's under the master of the eunuchs, right? There was another reason. If you're going to kill the king, you want to be able to start a dynasty. But if you can't father any children, you'll never father a dynasty. And so kings of the ancient world surrounded themselves with eunuchs, hundreds of thousands of eunuchs, so that two things, they couldn't mess with his women, and they had a less of a reason to kill the king because they could never have someone to succeed him, and everyone knew it. And so it was a very common thing. Well, in any event, he does the beauty contest. We know he picks Esther. And then we get up to chapter 3. Esther finds favor with everybody, right, by the way? And as soon as she spends the night with the king, she finds favor with him. She becomes the queen. And we get introduced to a man named Haman in chapter 3, verse 1.
Ooh.
Yeah. Haman is our star of the Feast of Purim. After these things, did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite? The Agagite is a reference to a king that was an Amalekite. His name was Agag, and Samuel was ordered to kill him and didn't. And so he becomes, way back there in the time of Solomon, in the time of Saul, which would be around 1000 B.C. or slightly before it, Agag is an enemy of the people of God. Now we're here in the year around 479, 478 BC. So we're half a millennia later. And you have to understand that what the book's setting up for the Jewish reader is, this is the mortal enemy of the Jewish people, an Agagite, an offspring of the one that Saul should have killed but didn't. And Mordecai is a Benjamite.
Who else was a Benjamite? Saul. Right? And so it's the idea of the wheels of justice in God's courtroom may grind slowly, but they grind exceeding fine. And so 550 years later, this little fight that started way back then is going to get brought to an end. Now, all the king's servants that were in the king's gates bowed and reverenced Haman, except one of them, and that, of course, is Mordecai. Would it have been wrong for Mordecai to bow? You know, when you read the book of Daniel, there's not one negative thing recorded about Daniel. When Daniel talks to Nebuchadnezzar, he says, "May the king live forever." Haman just won't do it. He won't pay homage, or Mordecai won't pay homage to Haman. And we might look at him as a hero, but in a lot of ways it's stupid. He not only runs the risk of his own skin, because all Haman had to do is go to the king and say, "Mordecai won't bow to me." Wasn't to bow in worship, it's to bow in respect. Mordecai won't do that, and so would you kill him? And the king would have said, "He's done deal. He's dead." He didn't do it. Why? Because it's not enough to have him dead. He wants to make him bow, and he just can't do it. And this becomes just an obsession of his to have Mordecai bow, and he won't do it. And so, and that really is what kind of starts pushing this story along. Well, Haman is full of wrath in verse 5 because Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. He wouldn't say something like, "Oh, Haman, live forever," that kind of thing. All I'm saying is there wouldn't have been a problem with doing it, in my opinion. And you can find a lot of Bible examples where one person bows to another. We talked about one for a whole lot in our study of Hebrews. Abraham essentially bows, pays homage to a man named Melchizedek. In Genesis chapter 14. It's not always wrong. But for whatever reason, and we're really not told why, other than we know as a Jewish reader, Mordecai and Haman should be enemies. He won't bow. Well, verse 7, in the first month, that is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, that means the 12th year of his reign, this helps us because it gives us a date. It's April or perhaps March of 474 B.C. Like, we know it precisely. And what happens? They cast Pur, that is lots. Think of it like dice, although it would have been made a little differently. Haman wants to know when the gods, plural, say he should kill the Jewish people. So he's gone from being angry at Mordecai to wanting to kill all the Jewish people. And the view was, and you see this in the book of Jonah, When they start seeing the storm come up, the prophet Jonah's asleep in the bottom of the ship, what do the sailors do? They cast lots, because that's how you discern the will of God. And so he figures out from casting lots what month and what day of the month he should try to kill the Jews, and then the plan is to go get the king to give him permission. And he does it the way we do our politics in the United States. Look what happens. Haman said unto the king Ahasuerus in verse 8, "There is a certain people," he never says who they are, that's important, "they're scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom, and their laws are diverse from all people," he's talking about the law of Moses, "neither keep they the king's laws," he's talking about Mordecai, not bowing, "therefore it's not for the king's prophet to suffer them. If it please the king, let it be written," to talk about writing a law, "that they may be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver." We know for a fact, when this man was king, his annual revenue was approximately just under 15,000 talents of silver. So this sum, 10,000 talents, Haman has a lot of money. And this is a bribe, right? It's a bribe. And but understand, he's offering him two-thirds of essentially the annual income of the kingdom. This is a ginormous sum of money. This would be millions and millions and millions of dollars in today's thinking, probably hundreds of millions. And it's just an enormous sum. A talent is a weight, and I forget how much, but it's exceedingly heavy. This isn't 10,000 ounces of silver. This is a lot. And he basically buys off the king. We could at least say it was a good influence. If he had thrown in another Esther, it would probably have been easier. Because the king had an insatiable appetite for money and women. In verse 12, then the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month. It was precisely my child's birthday, April the 14th, 474 B.C. the exact day. This is one of the neat things about Esther. You get these time markers. You know exactly when it happened. April the 14th, 474. And the decree is to kill them almost a year later on March the 7th, 473, which is also on a different calendar, Adar 13. So look at that point, though. He wants to kill them. And yet it comes out from throwing the dice that he has to wait almost a year. Who controlled how the dice came up? See, we have to look at it and say, where is the unseen hand of God? In Romans 1, he says, from the creation you see, you also see the invisible attributes of God. That is, that he is powerful, right, and that he exists. And so you have to look at events sometimes and say, just because I didn't have the experience Noah did, where he audibly heard the voice of God, is God in the event? And in this event, God's clearly there because he bought him a year. Why did he need to buy him a year? Because Esther is not a pious, religious Jew. To this point in the story, no one knows Esther's Jewish. No one knows that Mordecai's Jewish. And it's going to take some time for Mordecai and Esther to be used of God to save the people. And so what he's done here is through what we should call providence, and that's really the key to the whole book, providence. God is about the business of saving them. Why would God save them? Because he's not saving them because they're good people. He's not saving them because these folks are committed believers. It may be that some of them are, but you don't get any of that picture. You get Mordecai and Esther, neither one of whom are all that impressive in the sense that we don't see Mordecai praying. And we will see Esther call for a fast, and that's a good thing. But I'm just saying, why is God going to providentially save them? Well, let's think theologically, because something I've gone back to in almost every book we study is back to Genesis, because it always goes back to there, to the foundations for the Bible. God said something a long time ago, and it's if I could paraphrase it, you cannot, and he says this to the world, you cannot kill the Jewish nation. And that's been a truism forever. We have a lot of cultures have come and gone. There's people today that call themselves Persians, but this culture of this kingdom is gone. The Ninevites, the Assyrians, they're essentially gone. We're fairly new nation. The Jewish people, you know, other than the Chinese people, there's very few cultures that can really trace back a fairly consistent existence going back thousands of years. And the thing is, the world history seems to revolve around nations trying to destroy Israel. Egypt tried to kill them. The Babylonians tried to kill them. The Assyrians, Persians, the world events we see happening today, there's a reason they're trying to kill them, because it's a satanic issue, and that's a thing for another day. But just understand, God is providentially providing for them, and it goes all the way back to promises to Abraham in Genesis 12. He makes them again in 15, 17, 22. All these places, God says what? I'm going to make a mighty nation out of you. You're going to bless all the nations of the world, and you will have a future in security. That it is in peace and security. No one's going to overtake you. And even when God's allowed nations to overtake them as a judgment, he has said throughout the Old Testament, I'm going to regather you back into the land, and then it will never happen again. So just understand, we're seeing this providentially happen, and the basis are these promises in Genesis. Well, in chapter 4, Mordecai perceives there's a problem, chapter 4, verse 1, and it says he rent his clothes. Why would he tear his clothes? Now, in our culture, I could tear my shirt and just throw it away and put a new one on. In the ancient culture, most people didn't own a lot of clothes. So it was a big deal to tear your clothes. It was to take something of very much value to you and to rip it up in a way that was visible, to mourn visibly. In our culture, we don't like to mourn visibly. We don't like people to see our mourning. But that's not true in most of the world, and it's definitely not true here. But it was a sacrificial way to do it. And he rents his clothes and puts on sackcloth. That's a sackcloth is made out of like camel hair. Okay, it's the stuff that, John the Baptizer would wear in the first century as a prophet. So he is in a time of mourning because he knows the king's decree cannot be repealed. The king issues a decree at Haman's request, at Haman's bribe, to kill everybody. The decree goes out into the whole kingdom. History records that the Persian kingdom had a very efficient mail system. It was likened to our Pony Express. They would set up an outpost about every 20 miles, and so you would drive, 20 miles on a mule, and then the next person would then take the mail and move. And so they were able to get mail out in a very quick amount of time, probably quicker than we do now, to do this. And so it's going now through the whole country, and everybody's going to mourn like Mordecai because they know they're going to be dead. So in verse 8 of chapter 4, talking about Mordecai, he gave him, that is the messenger that could take the message back to Esther, he gave him the copy of the writing of the decree that was given at Shushan to destroy them. Now, by the way, everything happens at Shushan. The castle that everything happens in is still there. I mean, just go look at it on the internet. These aren't like places just made up. This is a vacation place if you saw fit to go to Iran. And the ruins are very well intact, I mean, generally speaking, for being so old. This is a real place. And it was the winter capital of the kingdom. There was a summer capital called Persepolis, which is also still there. And he built, Ahasuerus built a castle there that his father started and he finished. You went there in the winter because it was warm. In the summer, it was 140 degrees. You didn't want to go there then. One of the hottest places on the planet. So I'm assuming that they're probably not there in the summer. But in any event, from this place, Shushan, and the king's in the palace, the decree goes forward. And the problem is, I think Esther thinks she's going to skate by. And so Mordecai has the decree delivered to Esther here in verse 8 and tells the messenger to declare it unto her and charge her. He says, I want you to go tell Esther, because he can't talk to her himself because you're cut off from your family when you enter the harem. He says, you go talk to her and ask her to go to the king and make supplication. Well, Esther gives a response, and we're given some information in verse 11. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces do know, this is Esther talking, that whosoever, whether man or woman, shall come unto the king into the inner court, who is not called, there is one law of his to put him to death. If you just run into the king's presence, you're a dead guy. There's a few guys called princes that could come into him anytime they wanted. Everyone else, even his wife, could not. And so his response to Mordecai, her response to Mordecai is, I can't go to the king and talk to him, and he hasn't called me, you understand the reason, for 30 days, right? And so she feels like, it's kind of an easy excuse. He hadn't called on me. I can't go and tell him this. So that's what happens. And when it comes back to Mordecai, verse 13, Mordecai commanded to answer Esther. So you see the messages going back and forth. Think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. He says, Esther, just because you live in over there in the king's palace, eventually they're going to learn you're Jewish. And even the king cannot stop the decree from being carried forward, because that's the way Persian law works. And so you're going to die anyway. And so why don't you show some courage here? And in verse 14, this is one of the keys to the whole book, to seeing the providence of God. He says, and this is again Mordecai's words to Esther, for if thou, Esther, altogether hold your peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. What's he saying? You understand that often God works in what we do, not only in what we do that's good. So that Nebuchadnezzar, who was a very bad man, God calls his servant. And when we do wrong, we don't have the ability to stop God's determined will from occurring. So Mordecai says, and he doesn't ever say God, but you can see him thinking about the providence of God. He says, Esther, God's going to save his people. And if you're not going to be a part of it, it's still going to happen. And I would say that too to all of us. Jesus says, look, here's the plan. I got you a message here. We call it the gospel. take it to the world, to the ends of the earth, and he guarantees you it will get there. You read the book of Revelation, and some angels carry a placard, and it has the gospel written on it, and they sell it over the whole planet. The point is, the gospel does reach the ends of the earth. And one of us may say, but I'm not going to carry it. And God says, it's going to get there anyway. So you're either going to be part of my program, or you're against me. But it will happen. And that's kind of his message about providence here. He says, it's going to happen. But thou and thy father's house will be destroyed. See, there's consequences for our disobedience. We will never stop the will of God from being carried forward. And he says, and who knows whether you are come to the kingdom, to this Persian kingdom, for such a time as this. And I love that phrase. It's the one phrase we often will hear about from Esther. For such a time as this. See, everybody has these moments in their life, and often many of them, sometimes they're very small decisions, where in a way, God says, a lot of what's going on in the past, I've been preparing you for such a time as this. It may be something small. God preparing you just for trying to raise your kids right. Whatever the issue may be, and sometimes it's a really monumental decision, like this one Esther faces. Like I talked about in Hebrews 12, our lives are training programs for the world to come, and God is moving us forward if we'll be a part of the program. And at different points in our life, when we're faced with some pop quizzes and sometimes some major exams, God says, you're ready. And we may fail the test, but we never say it's because the teacher didn't get us ready. See, and Esther, she gets these words from Mordecai that are so piercing. Maybe. It's like, Esther, step back from this. You think because you were, you know, thankfully able to win the prize as Miss Persia, that's the reason you got the job. You were able to entertain the king, right? Step back from it and just think about history. Joseph starts out a slave, ends up the prime minister of Egypt. Daniel was a young man kidnapped from his home, ends up the prime minister of Babylon. And here you are, just this little girl. Your parents died. I adopted you. And now you're the queen? Hello, right? Providence of God. You have to see it. And we can do like Esther. And we start thinking about how everything seems like it's in the tank. And God says, there's a whole lot going on. And if you close your eyes for a moment, you'd see it. And he's telling that to Esther. And I think it is one of the applications for us. Well, Esther calls for a fast, and that's promising. It suggests to me she's reflected on the fact that God may be working in her life. And it's a 3-day and 3-night fast. Note, and I don't make a big deal about this, but just to say, she says fast for 3 days and 3 nights, but on the third day the fast ends. So it doesn't end up being 3 literal days and nights. And this just comes up when people argue about what Jesus meant when he said he'd be in the grave 3 days and 3 nights. Did it have to be 72 hours? The fast doesn't seem to last that long. But she calls for a fast. Why would people fast? Because in our culture, it's not done a lot. It ought to be, but we're just not very good at it. We like to eat too much. All right? Why can't I fast better? I'll tell you why. That's why I can't fast better. Right? I mean, I just like to eat too much. And we make all kinds of, I'm too busy to fast. No, you're not. It's not busy from where I'm standing. You know, but we make excuses. When we do this, I mean, there could be different reasons. Sometimes people fast for sorrow, but it's usually a time of intense prayer for deliverance. That's primarily it. In the New Testament, when people ask Jesus, why aren't your disciples fasting? And he gives them a very real response. Is, why on earth would you fast when you're standing in the presence of God? No, you fast when you're not standing in the presence of God, because you want to see his hand in your life. And he says, when the bridegroom leaves, then they'll fast. And so we in this time, as Christians, a primary emphasis on our fasting is for the second coming of the Lord. That's why the model prayer says, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. What's that a prayer for? It's a prayer for the second coming of Christ. In the book of Revelation, the prayers of the saints come up to the Father, and he says to Jesus, now you can go take it all. So we should fast as New Testament believers, but often in the Old Testament, it's a time of intense prayer for deliverance. She calls for a fast. And she ends up making some requests. We'll move through this quickly. She finally gets an audience with the king, and in chapter 5, verse 4, she tells the king that, "If it seems good to you, would you and Haman come to a banquet I'll make for you?" She invites him to a party. And he's all over, "Sure, we'll come to a party." So him and Haman come to a party. At the party, he says, "Okay, now tell me what you really want." And she says, "Well, if I found favor in your eyes, would you come to another party?" And, "Okay, well, I'll come to a second party, and I'll, you know, on the next day, and bring Haman too." And she brings Haman. And that third day, or that third time she's asked, "What do you want?" She says, "I want you to save my life, because I'm going to die and all my people." And he gets mad. It's like that time when Nathan tells the parable to David about a rich man that had a lot of sheep who went to this poor man who had one and stole it. And David gets all mad. He's ready to do vengeance on this evil rich man. And David says, "Who is the rich man?" And Nathan says, "It's you, because he stole Bathsheba." What's happened here? He gets them all mad and he says, "Who is going to kill my queen?" All right? And he's thinking, ain't nobody going to kill her. And she says, "Yeah, it's him." Oh, man. Right, this is not good, right? So, and there's some events I've skipped over, but you understand that Haman's in a heap of hurt. Haman's in a heap of hurt. And Haman, in the meantime, was doing a construction project. You remember from the story of Esther what the construction project was? Yeah, he built a gallows. I like this word because it's a very generic Hebrew word. One place in the King James it says tree. They didn't hang you by a rope. It's not Matt Dillon in the Old West. They impaled you on a big stick. And so when it says you were hung on the gallows, you were impaled on a stick. And the idea, Haman wanted a really high gallows for old Mordecai so he could hang him up there and view everybody. And it's providence of God again. Because when she points Haman out, the executors, it says they came and covered his face. That was how it was done in the Persian world. You cover their face where you execute them. Well, we need a gallows. Well, it just happens. Haman's built us one, and it's a really tall one. And the world will know what happens when you try to kill my queen. And so the king's all over it, and they go and impale him on that stick. That's basically what happens. Now, the problem is you still have this command we talked about to kill him on March the 7th. And so she goes and he says, "Do you have another request?" And she says, "Yes, issue a new command that the Jewish people can defend themselves." So the way it was going to work was, if you knew a Jewish guy at the end of the street and he had a nice Mercedes-Benz and a fine gun collection, you're just going to go kill him, right, and take his stuff. That was the law. That's what Haman did. The army wasn't going to go kill him. It just gave you free rein. And now he said, "Okay, you Jewish people, you get to shoot back, and you've got a long time to prepare for it." And so they had months and months in preparation. So what they did is, you know, they had all their guns out, and they were all loaded and ready to bear. And what happens? The people who come to kill them all die. And 500 of them die in the city alone, in Shushan. And he gives Esther one more request, which I think is request number 4 or 5. And she says, "Give us one more day to defend ourselves." And so it goes over an extra day. And they continue to defend themselves and kill some more of them. Haman's sons die. They're impaled up on sticks because they're the ones most likely to try to start a revolt or something like that. And the last thing just to mention is this gives rise to the Feast of Purim. And there's a lot of discussion about it. One of the reasons, I think the key reason for the book is providence. But if you're a Jewish person, you want to know where the Feast of Purim came. There's 7 feasts for Jewish people, and they're all in Leviticus 23 and some other places, but Leviticus 23 just lists them all out. And then we have other feasts that they've invented, like Hanukkah and the Feast of Purim. And so this told the Jewish people where the origin was of the Feast of Purim. Remember, Purim is lots. And so they casted the lots to see when to kill them, but God supernaturally delivered them. So you have essentially a feast that's 2 days long to celebrate the deliverance God had, that his providence to always preserve the Jewish nation. And it gives you that toward the end of the book, where, for example, in chapter 9, there's letters that go out that tell them about the feast. So in chapter 9, verse 20, Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters unto all the Jews that were in all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus, nigh and far, to establish the feast. Haman was second in command. He held the king's ring. In the old days, and in some cultures still today, you would sign a document with hot wax and you put that ring into it and would make your impression. That was the king's signature. It was his mark. When they hung Haman, he took that ring off and gave it to Mordecai. And a Jewish person saying, that's what you did with Joseph. That's what you did with Daniel. God providentially working. And we can get real discouraged, I think, about our politics across this country. And what I'm telling you is, you may not see it, but God has positioned people in certain places. And if it all crashes down, it will be because God in his judgment has allowed it to crash. And he pulls those people out. But he has people where you don't know. And I'm amazed sometimes how we'll get discouraged, and then we'll find out that in various places, in your workplace, on a professional sports team, God has positioned someone there. Where has he positioned you? See, you have that sphere of influence too for such a time as this, to be that influence. Will you be like Esther, who is inclined to say nothing? Or will you be like Mordecai, who says, you need to count the cost here. You need to see God's hand in this and your part in the program. And that's what this book's about. Well, let's bring it to a close. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you for the story of Esther and of Mordecai, a story that never references you directly, but we see your hand just pour off the pages. We pray that you'll impress upon us how in our lives we see your hand pour upon the pages, and in the blessings we have, and even in the trials, how you're working in our lives to mold us and shape us in the likeness of your Son. We pray you'll be with us as we go to worship, move in our hearts, keep us attentive to everything that you have for us today. And it's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.